Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Going to take a look at the world of wildlife today with David Drake. David, a wildlife specialist with UW Extension, associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at the UW. And he's been with us in the past. It's great to have him back. And I know there's always a lot of interest in our outdoors and our wildlife, so we really are pleased to have him with us. You may have some questions or comments about what's going on with the wildlife in your area. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. And also go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We already have a photo or two that are up for identification for David to identify. And you may have a photo that you want to just share, or you may have a question about something that is in that photograph, an animal. I hope you'll join us with by going to The Larry Mueller Show. We'll also, later on, I think afternoon, we're going to have a quiz to throw at you, and we're going to pick a winner at random from all the correct answers, and that person's going to receive a Stokes Guide to the Birds of the Eastern United States. So that's coming up later on. For now, David, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Larry. I appreciate the invite to be on.
Well, I'm glad you could be here. Let's start. There's a Wisconsin Badger project that's underway. I mean, who's doing it and what are the goals?
It's kind of a collaborative effort between the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, and the University of Wisconsin here in Madison. And there's a number of goals. They're trying to figure out some of the genetic structure of the badgers in the state of Wisconsin. So that's a lot of the genetics are being handled over the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. They're also trying to figure out just some general life history, traits, and ecology of the badger. And then also try to figure out how many there are in the state. And, and I was just out at the UW Day at the Fair, Day at the State Fair last Wednesday, and I brought our stuffed Bucky Badger with us. And that was one of the first questions a lot of people had is, well, are there a lot of them in the state? And you certainly get a lot of anecdotal evidence and reports from especially farmers who see them when they're up on their tractors and they see the badgers in the field. But nobody knows exactly how many there are out there, and that's one of the main goals of this project.
Will the public be involved in this, or is this a...
Yeah, very much. The public actually is being asked by the DNR to call in if they see either badgers, live badgers, badger burrows, or dead badgers on the side of the road. And there's a number to call in. Let's see. It is 414-229-4245. Or if you'd like to email your sightings of badgers, burrows, or roadkill, you can email that to badger@uwm.edu.
Badger@uwm.edu.
Right.
Okay.
So it's an exciting project. Everybody likes the badger. Everybody recognizes the badger, and we'll see what comes of it.
And as we think about the wildlife just in general across the state, now we're changing seasons a little bit. Anything out there that you're seeing of a concern, or things look pretty good? Or
I think it's kind of things look pretty good. You know, it seems like a lot of with a lot of the birds, they got off to a kind of a late nesting start this year, probably due to the kind of cold, wet spring we had this year. As a matter of fact, I was just up in northern Wisconsin at the end of last week, and I saw some turkey poults that looked like they just hatched out, which is pretty late in the year for them to be that small. So we'll see if they make it through the winter or not.
Yeah, that'll be interesting.
But there's some good news out of the prairies here in North America, that the overall duck population is up 11% over last year for the ducks that they survey. And a couple of duck species in particular, the blue-winged teal is up 40% reproduction-wise over last year, and pintail is up about 25%. So there are some good things about that. Things are starting to put weight on to get ready for hibernation for those animals that hibernate. We've got bats and birds. We'll start migrating south here pretty soon with the upcoming winter and colder weather. And so there's always something going on, and it's kind of a neat transitional period right now.
You know, David sent a message on our Facebook page saying yesterday was one of the great days for seeing wildlife. You know, that sometimes happens. He spotted a black bear, a couple of eagles, a flock of sandhills, and a badger.
All right, David. Well, call into that number or email badger@uwm.edu, and if you could please report the badger sighting to as specific location as you possibly can, the DNR certainly would appreciate that. And all those other things, black bear, eagles, flocks of sandhills, is really unique to be able to see all that interesting wildlife, no doubt.
In one day, that's great. And we had another Facebook, a photograph, and I hope people go to the Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show to take a look at. This is from, let's see, who is it from? It's from Bill, and he said, I'm trying to send a picture of what I believe is a timber rattlesnake we saw at Devil's Lake on Saturday. It was exciting to see. You think it's a timber rattler or is something else?
Well, you know, we've got 21 snake species here in Wisconsin. Two of those are venomous snakes. One's the timber rattlesnake, one's the Massasauga rattlesnake. And the Massasauga is a state endangered species. The timber rattlesnake is a species of protected animal. The snake that I'm looking at that Bill sent a picture in of looks like a northern water snake. And if Bill wants to call in, we can maybe talk to him a little bit more about where he found the picture. I know it's at Devil's Lake State Park. But the snake's perched on a rock, and it looks like it has a pointed tail and not a tail with rattles on it. Mm-hmm. It's got very distinct banding on it, black bands on a kind of a brownish body. And although the head looks like it's a little bit triangular, which is indicative of a venomous snake, water snakes sometimes do have kind of a triangular appearing head. So, Bill, if you saw that, I would ask you to maybe think back in your memory bank. And one of the things that you'd want to look for is if you saw the belly of the snake. For a northern water snake, they've got kind of a red crescent bands across their belly. But to me, I think it's a northern water snake, and that certainly is a common snake, and is a much more common snake than timber rattlesnakes. But timber rattlesnakes certainly are up in the Devil's Lake State Park area, and there's a possibility, but the snake I just saw in the picture looks more like a northern water snake to me.
Well, I'm inviting everybody else to take a look and see what they think at the Larry Mueller Show. It's a nice picture.
It was a beautiful picture.
Yeah, beautiful
Absolutely.
Picture. Sam in Superior has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Sam.
Hi there.
What's on your mind?
Now, I'm living about 30 miles east of Superior, and lately I've been hearing some unofficial reports of people, reputable people, seeing cougars in the area, but there haven't been any official sightings that I know of. And I'm just wondering what you know about cougars in Wisconsin, if there have been any official sightings.
Sure.
Information.
All right. David, what do you think?
Well, Sam, I will thank you very much for being the first caller with a question that I actually can field. That is a very good question, and there has been a renewed interest, and there's always, I think, interest in some of these top predators like cougars and things like that, but there's especially been a renewed interest with the news that came out maybe 3 weeks or so ago about the cougar that was killed in Connecticut in the beginning of June, and that cougar left South Dakota, moved around the Twin Cities through Wisconsin, and made essentially a 1,500-mile journey between South Dakota until it was hit by a car and killed in Connecticut. So the cougars are certainly increasing in eastward dispersal, if you will. Within, I say, maybe since 2008, there have been four confirmed cougar sightings here in Wisconsin. And what is believed to be happening with the cougars is that in South Dakota, the cougar population is actually increasing because they've got very good habitat out there and it's sparsely populated with people.
Yeah.
And with a lot of top predators, after those young get to be a certain age, they kind of get pushed out of that habitat or that territory by the adults, and they are forced to go find someplace else to live. And because South Dakota is getting kind of filled up with cougars, the cougars are starting to move in different directions, and one of those directions is into Minnesota and into Wisconsin. And so it is possible that we're going to see more official sightings of cougars here in Wisconsin. We certainly have the habitat that can support them. And it's very possible that people are seeing cougars in Superior. What you'd want to do if you think you have a cougar, either cougar scat, which is just a polite euphemism for poop, or cougar tracks, or you actually have what you think is a cougar picture on perhaps a game tracker, is notify Adrian Weideven, who's the big game carnivore biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and they'll have somebody come out and take a look.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thanks, Sam, for calling. Appreciate your call. Helen in Rhinelander, on to you now. Hi, Helen.
Hi there. I love feeding the birds, but I'm not so fond of the bears that attracts to my deck.
Yeah.
So my question is, when is it safe to start putting bird seed out again? When do the bears start hibernating or are no longer interested in my bird seed?
Well, that's a good question as well, Helen. And I will say, as long as they're out in the landscape and active, they will always be interested in your bird seed. But probably by, sometime October into November, they should start be heading into the hibernation dens, and you should be safe. I would say, probably by early to mid-November, something like that. And definitely by late November, you should be safe with that. So I think that would be a good time.
Great. I don't have to wait till there's snow on the ground.
No, that's right. And the birds will appreciate it very much as well.
And into the spring also, is it again until the snow is gone, or is it a certain month or so that I should put a halt to it, or do I wait till the first bear appears?
Well, you can certainly wait until the first bear appears, but the risk you run the risk you run with doing that, and I should say, if you perch your seed out in the fall and a bear appears, please take your seed down and then maybe try it a week or two later. The risk you run with having a bear come to your feeder, either in the fall or the spring, is once they get keyed in on a food source, they keep coming back. And you do not want a habitual bear coming back to your feeder. So sometime by end of March or so, they're out of the dens and active again.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Helen.
Thanks a lot for calling. David Drake, wildlife ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network. You can join in with questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR or post a comment on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Facebook comment from Ross. Hi, Larry and Dave. Please talk about the condition of bats in Wisconsin. I live on the north side of Madison. I'm not seeing any.
Oh, and that's a good question as well. So there's a couple of concerns with bats right now, especially with the cave bats that hibernate. And we've got really, for the most part, seven bat species here in Wisconsin. The eighth is the federally endangered Indiana bat, but that has not been seen for decades and really only occupies the very southern part of our state. So we've got roughly four species that are cave hibernators. And since, I guess, about 2006 or so, there's a disease that has really been having just devastating effect on cave hibernating bats, and that's the white nose syndrome.
Yep.
So when a lot of people don't see bats, that obviously is a natural thing to jump to that conclusion. To my knowledge, we have not found white nose syndrome in Wisconsin yet, and hopefully we will not find it. Bats are kind of an interesting thing. You know, they certainly, because they're insectivores, they move around where the insects are. And I personally have not seen a lot of mosquitoes or felt a lot of mosquitoes in our yard, although other people are in some other parts of the state. So if the mosquito population or the flying insect population perhaps is not as abundant this year in your yard as it was in previous years, that could be an explanation. Especially in urban, suburban-type settings, we have a lot of bats, and big brown bat in particular, likes to hibernate and occupy, you know, dwellings that we also like to occupy, like buildings and things like that. And sometimes if the roost gets displaced, so either the roost was taken out of a building or has been forced out of a building and is not allowed back in, that can sometimes cause bats to move different locations on the landscape as well. So there could be a couple of reasons. And then finally, it could just be the fact that, you know, sometimes we're more observant some years than others, and it could just be a fact that that they're out there, and perhaps they're out there at times that you are not out there.
You know, that brought to mind an experience that I had with my daughter. We were going for a walk in our neighborhood and saw a dead crow along the side of the lawn, actually. And that got me thinking about there was some disease of birds that was creating issues, and I wonder about that. If you know what I'm talking about, I'm pretty sure.
Yep, I sure do. So the crow population in years past, I think it may have slowed down a little bit, was affected by mosquitoes that were infected with the West Nile virus. Mm-hmm. And so crows seemed to be most susceptible, but other birds like blue jays were also susceptible. And so they're still monitoring West Nile virus. I don't know that I don't know that it's as big of an issue as it first was when it came on the landscape. But if you do see dead crows like that, or especially if you see more than one, because certainly, you know, they can just, you know, obviously crows can die just natural causes of predation or whatever. But especially if you see more than one, certainly call the USDA Wildlife Services hotline. They've got a West Nile virus hotline, or you can also call your county health department, and I'm sure they can direct you to somebody to speak with.
Our guest today, David Drake, talking with him. He's a wildlife specialist with UW Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. He'll be with us up until 12:30 today. Larry Mueller here. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have lots of callers online to ask questions for you, Dave. So, David, I'm going to go to June in Oconomowoc right now. June, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I have a hedgehog who has undermined my rock wall that holds up the hill next door. And I have a live trap and I want to know what to bait it with.
Okay. Well, so let's start out, June, with the species in question. I'm guessing perhaps you mean a groundhog instead of a hedgehog. Is that possible?
Probably so.
Okay, because yeah. Hedgehogs are not a native species to Wisconsin, and it's not that they can't be out there, but if they are, they're probably released from somebody's pet.
He's not rare, I don't think.
No, okay. Yep, so groundhogs are a native rodent here to Wisconsin, very common, especially in urban, suburban type areas, and they can be very destructive because of all the burrowing they do. So, and typically hedgehogs have multiple openings to their burrow, but the openings that are used most frequently usually have a mound of dirt in front of them.
A huge amount.
Yep, exactly. So look for that. And the easiest thing to do is, as you've indicated, get a live trap, a large enough trap that you can fit the animal into. And I think some of the best baits are to take an apple and either quarter the apple or halve it, and then put a drop or two of just imitation vanilla on each apple. And that is like Spanish fly for hedgehogs, groundhogs.
Great.
And then what you want to do is make sure that you want to put the opened end of that trap right next to the opening of the burrow. And a couple other hints, possibly, if you can cover that trap either with an old burlap sack or an old blanket or towel or something like that, that encloses the trap and makes it dark in there. It'll make the animal feel more secure about going into that trap. And on these hot summer days, it'll also provide some shade. And lastly, groundhogs are diurnal, so they're active during the day. So in the evening, as your sun's going down, shut the trap. So close the trap down and then open it first thing in the morning, and you'll avoid catching skunks and raccoons and other nocturnal animals you don't want in there.
Thank you. I heard, and tell me if this is not proper, that dog poop, if you throw it into the hole.
Well,
is that a myth?
It's a myth, yeah. It may work, but I can guarantee you with a live trap and some apple, you can catch that animal. I cannot guarantee you with dog scat that you're going to do much of anything.
Oh, thank you.
But yeah. Good luck.
Good luck. Thank you for calling. And we have Gary in Milton up next. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I live in rural Rock County, and I'm pretty attuned to butterflies and dragonflies, so I look at them closely every year. And this year, I have seen far more tiger swallowtails than I've ever seen in all the years I've been up here. And I'm in Madison this morning, and I stopped by the Arboretum Curtis Prairie, and it was filled with tiger swallowtails. I wonder if you know anything about the prevalence of this lovely butterfly species and whether this is just a regional thing in southern Wisconsin or whether it's more widespread in the state or even beyond Wisconsin.
Well, Gary, I hate to disappoint you, but I don't know much about them at all. So I think you'll have Phil Pelletieri on, right?
We have Phil coming up next week on Wednesday.
So perhaps, Gary, if you can, maybe try to call back next Wednesday. And I'm guessing that Phil will be a much better resource than I would be.
He'll have a good answer. Thank you, Gary. And, yeah, he is on for the whole 90 minutes on Wednesday of next week. Scott in La Crosse, we're on to you now. Hi, Scott.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I was down in New Glarus, and we were on the bicycle trail at about dusk. And what we thought was a large raccoon cross in front of us, and then as we saw it, it almost appeared to be a wolverine. And then I went online and looked up, and I think it might have been a fisher. Is that possible?
It very well could be.
Are they common?
Yeah, they are more common up north in the northern part of the state than they are other parts of the state. But there have been accounts of fishers moving south in the state of Wisconsin. As a matter of fact, in July, I was at Farm Tech Days, and a gentleman from Wisconsin had stopped by our wildlife booth, and he said, I was driving around the Twin Cities, and he says, I think I saw a fisher. And from his description, it certainly sounded like a fisher. So they are moving around. And Gary or Scott, just to confirm, so fishers are all black for the most part, and actually comparing to a wolverine is not a bad comparison. Because they generally have that
real black bushy tail, but almost a real dark brown body.
Yep, that sounds like a fisher.
Okay. It was pretty good size. I was impressed at how big it was. And of course, My buddy was from Michigan, so of course it was a wolverine. And
well, we don't have any wolverine. If you,
I found out they are definitely were way too south for that, but it was interesting. I was glad to see something like that.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like a fisher. They are much more common up north, as I mentioned, and they usually use a lot of very old growth forests with a lot of dead down timber on the ground and kind of a closed canopy, you know, with some pretty large diameter trees in those forests. But they are certainly moving south.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're definitely as far south as New Glarus. So
well,
thank you very much.
That's pretty neat you saw it. So
done. Thanks for calling. And on to Randy in Green Bay. Hi, Randy.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Good. Just wondering about Lyme's disease. I've been hearing so much different things lately about now mosquitoes can carry it, and we have some land up in Townsend and little kids, and I'm just, you know, kind of worried. What time of the year are they out? What do you worry about? You know, how long do they have to be on you? I talked to someone walking their dog last week, and she said, oh, I don't think there's any deer ticks or Lyme's disease up here, but then I heard a show saying, you know, more and more are testing positive for it all the time, so... Just curious on that.
Well, that's a good question, Randy, and you're wise to just be cautious about that. Anytime you're in areas, you know, with good vegetation, grass and things like that, and you're walking, you should definitely check yourself when you come out of the woods and come out of those kind of brushy, grassy areas. Lyme disease is a real issue. It's, you know, plenty of people contract it each year. It is by the deer tick. And white-footed mice are reservoirs for them. And although the deer carry plenty of deer ticks, deer are actually not a reservoir for Lyme disease, but they can certainly carry infected ticks, and they can carry a lot of them on their body. So the best thing for you to do when you're walking in the woods is wear long pants, perhaps tuck your pants into your socks if you can. And you can, you know, some people even tape their pants around their ankles. You can wear rubber boots, knee-high rubber boots. And then when you get out of the woods, just be very vigilant, you know, strip down and just check yourself for ticks and make sure you don't have any. If you do have a tick on you and you've identified as a deer tick positively, usually within 24 to 48 hours, if you can get the tick off of you, you're okay. But if you have any concerns at all, you certainly should check with your family doctor. And if you see a bullseye type red spot on your body where the tick bite is, you definitely should check with your doctor and just go in and make sure that they can test you for Lyme disease, but also just have a medical professional look at that.
All right. There you go. Thanks, Randy. Appreciate your call. We have an email from Kate in Lodi. We live in a rural area adjacent to marsh and woodland and are overrun by rabbits this year. They're destroying a lot. Our lawn is about half white clover, but they prefer the lilies, the English daisies, and the larkspur. Is it legal to shoot them as a nuisance animal at this time of year? If not, any suggestions?
Kate, yes, it is legal to shoot them any time of the year that they're causing damage on property that you actually own. Now, the caveat to that is you need to make sure that it's legal to discharge a firearm in the municipality in which your property is and where the damage is occurring. As long as it's legal for you to discharge a firearm, you're welcome to declare harvest season on the rabbits. Get yourself a good rabbit recipe and cook them up. But if not, other suggestions, if you cannot shoot them, the easiest thing to do is you can certainly live trap them and then kill them, or you can live trap them and release them if you wish. But they're also relatively easy to exclude from areas where you don't want, and you know, really just need to put up a fence maybe a foot or two high and keep them out of your flower beds and things like that, and certainly, you know, choose a fence that is aesthetically pleasing for you.
Facebook comment from Bridget. I'm seeing signs that the skunk is back in my garden digging for worms and grubs. I've also seen some butterflies I've never seen before this far north in the Green Bay area, like the great spangled fritillary and giant swallowtail. Lots of butterflies this year, but to the skunks.
Yep. Yeah, so we've already established I know nothing about butterflies, so I will stick with the skunk question here. So just to confirm that, I'm sure you've seen the skunks in there, but skunks also, a lot of times when they root around in your yard, they leave kind of a conical shaped hole in your yard, and it's usually wider at the top of your lawn, and it gets more narrow as it goes into the soil. So that's what, and essentially what they're doing is they're just rooting around there with their nose and their mouth. So a couple of things you can do, certainly The damage that they're doing to your yard, unless they're really digging it up with their forepaws, a lot of the damage they do from just rooting around their nose is temporary, and it will take care of itself as the grass just fills itself in. So you can do nothing if you wish to. You can try a kind of a grubicide if you want to put something in the lawn to reduce the amount of worms or grubs in there. There's some caveats with that, that you know certainly those grubs and worms are good for soil aeration. They provide a lot of food source for other animals as well. So there are some consequences with that. Again, you're welcome to live trap those skunks if you wish to. And once you live trap them, you can either dispatch them or release them. Or again, if you're in an area where it is legal for you to discharge a firearm, that skunks are one of those species that on property you own, when damage is occurring, you're welcome to harvest them at will.
Tom in Iron County would like to know how he can deter sandhill cranes from attacking his basement window screens.
Well, that is a new one on me, Tom, that they're attacking the basement window screens.
I wonder if they're attacking the view that they see on the glass.
Yep, which is very common. A lot of birds will certainly, when they see a reflection of themselves, they see it as a competitor, and they'll start attacking that glass.
And sandhills are very territorial.
They are. They are very territorial. So there's a couple of things you can do. If you are out and about and you see the sandhill cranes out there, just go out and shoo them out of the area, harass them, and make it as negative an experience as possible for them so that they realize or associate, you know, I came in here and something bad happened to me. So if you can do that. You can certainly maybe try taking the screens off and perhaps putting some kind of a shadow or some kind of a decal on your window that would perhaps break up that reflection and see if that works, and then put the screens back on or just leave the screens off for a little while until the sandhill cranes go on their way.
And Mary in Adams County, we turn to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hi, I'm wondering if you can know anything about an importation question on raccoon dogs. And why is it so hard to get them imported to the United States for educational reasons or as a pet for educational reasons in the state of Wisconsin?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know that I have necessarily an answer for you, but who is holding up the importation, a particular department or agency?
USDA, because you have to have a captive wildlife license, which you can get from the state of Wisconsin, but then you also have to have the captive wildlife license from the United States of America. It's like an indigenous species, or I believe it's an indigenous species, and that's what I'm wondering why it's so hard. I mean, raccoon dogs are not. Are they afraid that something's going to happen if they get imported into the United States to them, or? That's what I was wondering.
I don't know the answer to that question, Mary. And let me ask you a clarification. What kind of a breed is a raccoon dog?
Okay, you don't know what it is.
Well, I'm familiar
with it. It's a wild animal.
I'm familiar with what people down south call raccoon dogs are like blue tick, hounds, and things like that.
No, sir. It is not. A raccoon dog is the kind of dogs that they use for the fur trading over in China. And there's some horrific videos on YouTube of them skinning them alive. It's terrible. They're associated with the red panda in China. Their technical classification is an exotic dog.
Well, and if that's the case, I think the issue is that the USDA and the U.S. government is very concerned about bringing more exotic animals of any kind into the country.
Yep, absolutely. You know, I think perhaps, Mary, if you have a chance, call somebody at the USDA or one of the customs offices and see if they've got an explanation for you, because I certainly don't.
Yeah, I wish we could help you out there, but I think just in general, exotics are kind of frowned upon.
Yep, and we've got plenty of them here. We definitely don't need more.
Thanks for calling. You can join in, too, by the way, with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And speaking of the Facebook page, Bill, who posted the photo of the timber rattler on the Facebook page, shared his note he got from the Bureau of Endangered Resources.
All right.
So he sent something in there. He said, you most definitely do have a timber rattlesnake there.
Well, there you go.
Nice find. I'm going to pass along your pictures and the snake's location to our biologists, so if they have any further questions, they can get in touch with you.
Well, thanks. That's pretty exciting. To me, it looked like a northern water snake from the pointed tail, but the snake also had a black tail, which is indicative of a timber rattlesnake. So, well, that's very good. Excellent.
And then we have from Maryland and Beaver Dam, a few days ago I saw a male cardinal with a black featherless head. The rest of the body looked normal. Was it molting or something else? Well, probably something else.
It probably is something else. Perhaps it has some kind of a disease on its head that's caused the feathers to be lost or something. And featherless head, certainly some birds, if the structural integrity of those feathers gets damaged, it can reflect or absorb different colors within the color spectrum, and it can actually change the normal color of that bird. But since you've indicated a featherless head, that doesn't seem to be the case here. And so I would guess that some kind of a disease or perhaps mites or something like that have gotten on that bird and have caused either the feathers to drop out, or the bird has been scratching its head so much that it's actually pulled the feathers out as it scratches its head.
Sue and Woodruff, we are on to you now. Hi, Sue.
Hi. See, I have a problem with porcupines. Uh-huh. They're chewing at our shed and wood and whatever else they can find.
Okay.
On the corners of the shed or?
Actually, on the doors. Like this one door to the shed, they almost have it chewed all the way through. And the problem is when we're up there, because this is like our second cottage, and when we're up there, we can take care of them. But, of course, when we're not up there, we don't know what to do.
Okay. Yep, and that's a good question. That's a relatively common problem with porcupines. They like to chew on a lot of things. Again, they're one of the rodent species, and rodents love to gnaw on a lot of different stuff to keep those front teeth filed down. So there's a couple of options for you. On those areas where, for example, the door of the shed that is getting damaged, you could, if you want to, replace that door with a metal door that cannot be chewed on. On any of the corners of the shed, you could take either hardware cloth, which is just a wire mesh, or you could take like a sheet metal type material and put that on the corners of the shed where the chewing is occurring. And you probably want to put it all the way up to the roof line, I would guess, because the animal may just, if you only put it where the chewing's occurred so far, the animal may just move further up that corner. Alternatively, if you want to, and when you're up there, you can try to trap the animal with a live trap.
Mm-hmm.
Again, use bait, like you put some wood in there or perhaps some apple or something like that. See if you can catch the animal and then relocate it someplace. Or you could also look in your yellow pages and see if there's a wildlife control officer up there that might trap for you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right.
Now, if you would catch it and live trap it, how far would you have to take it so it wouldn't come back?
Well, you should probably take it, I would guess, a good 5 miles away or so. Mm-hmm. And with live trapping, obviously, anytime you live trap an animal and you release it on private property you don't own, you need that property owner's permission to do so. A lot of times people will release them on public land, either local, county, or state land, and you're welcome to do that. But typically it's recommended that you get the permission of the manager of that land prior to doing it. And porcupines are, again, another one of those things where I believe you are able to shoot porcupines at the time the damage is occurring. So if you're up there and you see it actually causing problems and you are inclined to shoot it, I believe you are within your legal right to do so.
Okay, very well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Suzanne in Escanaba, Michigan. On to you. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. I recently moved from the Milwaukee area to the UP of Michigan, and I was truly horrified when I saw an ad for the trappers that were going to get together and have a meeting. And I said, I cannot believe that this is actually still happening. Well, I happened to go to the UP State Fair. The trappers had a booth, and there all these hideous, barbaric traps were hanging on the wall. And I asked him, I said, what's up with this? I can't believe that this is still happening. Well, his explanation was there's too many. There's too many beavers. There's too many. And I said, I never see these animals. How can that be? I guess my question to you is there still trapping in Wisconsin? And is it because of the fur trade? Or is it truly because of this is, control of the numbers? And isn't there a better way to get these animals rather than catch their leg in a trap for them to suffer until they eventually die?
Well, that's a good question, Susan, and there's a lot of people who certainly have concerns over trapping. So let me do my best to allay any concerns you have. And I will say that nationally, the Wildlife Society has worked with a number of trapping agencies across the country and state agencies, and the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is one of those agencies, to develop national standards that are called best management practices for trapping. And the idea is to make trapping as humane as it possibly can be. And so they have changed the design of traps to the point where some traps might have offset jaws, that they don't hold that leg and do as much damage to the leg and leg hold traps, for example. Or you can change the tension of the spring so that there's not as much damage done to the leg. And there, trapping, and I know this is kind of an oxymoron, but trapping has really become a very humane way to manage wildlife. And in particular, wildlife like beavers and other fur bearer animals that are typically secretive and can be nocturnal. And that's one of the reasons you don't see them a lot of times, because they are secretive animals. And trapping is really one of the more cost-effective and one of the most cost-effective ways to control some of those species. And if we don't control things like beavers, for example, they just do so much damage and will flood timberland and can actually completely wreck the economic value of a timber property. They'll dam up culverts and flood roadways and things like that. And as much good as beavers do by changing that landscape and damming up things for other animals like moose and waterfowl and other fur bearer animals, they can do damage, and at times they certainly need to be controlled, and trapping is the most cost-effective way to do that.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thank you, Suzanne, for calling. Appreciate it. Mike in Ephraim, we're going to you next. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Just a quick question here. I'm a physician at a boys' camp in upper New York State where there's a great concern that bats are a reservoir for rabies. What's the status of that in Wisconsin?
Well, bats certainly are one of the more common carriers of rabies, and typically the more common species that carry rabies are either bats or skunks, and one year it might be skunks might be the most common carrier, and another year bats might be the most common carrier. So it certainly is a concern, and I think you just want to be careful that if you see a bat that is not acting normal, and this is true for any animal like a raccoon or a fox or a skunk, that if they don't look like they're acting normal, and for example, if it's a nocturnal animal and they're out during the daytime wandering around aimlessly and they're salivating in large amounts, you know, certainly that would be cause for concern. Same for bats as well. So if you do find a bat that you think is rabid, if you can kill it, I think certainly do so and bring it to the county health department for testing, especially if there's a bat that is, for any bat that is in quarters where you know, residential quarters where people also live, you want to make sure you get that bat out of there. And if there's any concern at all, certainly kill the bat and bring it into the county health department for testing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Thank you. One other question. Do you know of any cases of human rabies from a bat bite in Wisconsin?
Where people have gotten rabies from bats?
Yes.
I don't personally know, but I would be shocked if there was not a case such as that, simply because bats are one of the more common carriers of rabies, and bats are a relatively common species in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, terrific. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Christine in Mequon has a question for you. Hi, Christine.
Hi. Hi, Larry. What a great show you have.
Thank you.
I garden at it's a naturalized, restored prairie, wetland, woodland at our church. And we have these little structures that are happening on the grounds. They're mud, like domes or chimneys. And they're about, 6 to 8 inches in diameter. Mm-hmm. And there's a tunnel that goes down into the ground, and occasionally there's a roof on it, and occasionally there isn't.
Yeah. Mud daubers?
So now by a roof, do you mean that the soil has been pushed upward toward the sky?
I don't know if it's been pushed up or if it's been put on top.
Okay. So what I'm thinking, and you said wetland, which kind of keyed me in on this species, I'm wondering if it's not a star-nosed mole that you have,
M-O-L-E. Yeah.
And we have two mole species in Wisconsin, the eastern, or the more common mole is the eastern mole, and then we have the star-nosed mole. And star-nosed moles are found typically down more where the soil is wet and kind of muckier, and they do make these little mud chimneys, very similar to what crayfish would do, for example. If you have a chance to Google or look up on the internet star-nosed mole, take a look at the animal. It's a fascinating-looking little animal, and they've got they're called star-nosed moles because they've got this kind of a fleshy star-like appendage where their nose is, and it's thought that that has got just a tremendous amount of nerve endings there, and it's one of the ways that they go and are able to find food in the soil. So it sounds to me like you have a star-nosed mole there. If they're not doing any damage, or if the damage they're doing, you can tolerate it, let it be. If they are doing damage, you need to get rid of them. I think the easiest way to do so is go to your local hardware store and get a Victor harpoon trap. It's V-I-C-T-O-R, harpoon trap, and about $15. On the side of the box, they have very explicit, very well-detailed directions on how to set that trap for an effective capture. And usually within 12 to 24 hours, you'll have a mole.
Okay. What kind of damage would I be looking for?
Well, typically moles, what happens is they, like 99% of their life, they live beneath the soil, in the soil. And so as they tunnel, and they're active year-round, but during the winter months when we have frozen soil, they go beneath the frost layer, so you don't ever see this. But during the warmer months when they tunnel, they push the soil upwards. So if you are walking, for example, across the yard and the soil kind of collapses beneath your foot, that is a very good indication that you have a mole in there. Unless you're in the far western part of the state, then you also may be dealing with gophers out there, mm-hmm. Pocket gophers. But it sounds to me from Mequon, where you are, that it most likely is a star-nosed mole.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, other people have mentioned crayfish, but...
That's a kind of a big area for a crayfish. So would a crayfish have a 6-inch diameter?
That sounds too big
to
me.
Yeah, it sounds too big to me, too.
And they also would... crayfish would not create the kind of tunnels it sounds like you're describing.
Yeah, that's right.
But mm-hmm. So if you do catch it, take a look at the nose, that star-nosed appendage on his nose. It is really an interesting animal.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. From moles, let's go to voles. Mary wonders how to get voles out of her garden.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was waiting for Mary.
V-O-L-E-S.
You didn't sound like Mary, Larry. all right, Mary. So it sounds most likely like you've got the meadow vole, and that's the most common vole you'd have in that area. The easiest thing to capture moles is to get yourself a snap trap, like a mouse-sized or rat-sized snap trap, most likely a mouse-sized snap trap. Bait it with peanut butter, and where you see mole activity, typically they have surface runways, and you'll see where they've kind of worn a path through the vegetation, or you may see some surface runways in the soil. Where you see that, after you've baited your trap with peanut butter, set the trigger of the trap in the runway, and you should have a mole. Now, it's going to be a vole. Meadow voles are very, very common, and it is very possible that you've got more than one in your yard, so you probably want to keep a trapping program going. And especially vole populations can rise and fall, cycle over the next 2 to 5 years or within 2 to 5 years. And a lot of times they're active, well, they are active year-round. A lot of times they can be very damaging in the winter when we don't see them as they run underneath the snow, and they can do a lot of damage, especially to woody vegetation. So if you are trapping them and you're finding quite a few of them, I would continue a trapping program through the fall into the right up to the winter.
David Drake, our guest wildlife specialist with UW Extension, associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. Our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Drake, our guest answering your wildlife questions here today on the Ideas Network. Thank you for calling in and listening and emailing and going to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. I really appreciate it. Tyler from Walworth County sent an email. I've heard rumors lately about Wisconsin joining several other states and allowing a hunting season for sandhill cranes. Does your guest know anything about this?
I do not know anything about this, but there are sandhill crane seasons in other states. I believe Minnesota has one. Nebraska's got them.
Dakotas?
Yeah, I think the Dakotas have them as well. And I don't know if you've ever eaten sandhill crane, but I've had sandhill crane breast, and it is delicious. So... I don't know that there's a movement like that afoot here in Wisconsin. I know if that was the case, that a lot of farmers would be very happy because cranes do a tremendous amount of agricultural damage to their corn crops and things like that. And it certainly seems like there's cranes everywhere in Wisconsin. You know, when you drive around, you see them a lot of places. I'm not sure what the population is. I'm not sure anybody knows what the population of the sandhill cranes in Wisconsin is. But it certainly seems, just from observation, that that population probably could sustain a hunting season if one were to be enacted. But I'm not aware that there is any active movement afoot to do that.
Yeah, I haven't heard of any either. Facebook question from Mark. I recently moved and my new home has chipmunks living on the property. I noticed that there are two now. I only saw one at first. They've been digging around the foundation. Is there a non-lethal way to repel these pesky little critters? A trap again? Mouse trap?
Yeah, you can certainly use a live trap, which is, if you want to go online, you can just Google Sherman live trap. It's S-H-E-R-M-A-N. You can buy a trap that would fit a chipmunk for maybe $10 to $15, something like that. And you'd want to bait it with peanut butter or maybe like a peanut butter oat or peanut butter sunflower seed mix. And typically what you would do is, just to keep the trap a little bit cleaner, is you would just take a dollop of peanut butter and you would wrap it in maybe a 2 or 3 inch square piece of paper towel and then just dump that bait into the back of the trap and set the trap where you see the activity or where you see holes or burrows for the chipmunks. You can try to exclude them. A lot of times people will plant bulb gardens, for example, and the chipmunks will go in and dig up those bulbs. And so, you know, after you plant the bulb garden, you might want to put chicken wire and stake chicken wire down across the soil. And then you can top fill that if you want to, or top dress it with mulch or more soil, whatever you want to do. And once you are guaranteed you got them out of there, if you can backfill those holes, either with some small pea gravel or sand, and tap that down as tight as you can and try to exclude them from those holes, new ones from coming back into those holes, that would be good as well. Especially around your foundation. You don't want water leaking in there and flooding.
Connie and Cameron, on to you now. Hi, Connie.
Good morning. Just a question about river otters. We were raising some meat bird chickens, and they were about 1 week away from what we affectionately called freezer camp. And we had them in a run, and then we enclosed them in at night. And broad daylight, a river otter got into, we live along the Red Cedar River, got into the pen and just went on a murder rampage and killed 11 out of the 12 chickens. And by the time my son got out there, there was one left, which he grabbed out. But we were concerned mainly with, you know, predators at night. But how common would that be that he was so bold during the day?
Well, let me just make sure that we were talking about an otter. And you saw the animal.
We saw the animal. He was in the pen, and he was actually quite bold because it took a lot to shoo him away. And then when my husband was actually butchering the chickens, as he was throwing things on a refuse pile, he was coming up and getting them.
And so can you describe roughly how big this animal was? How long was it, for example?
Well, my son saw him, but he's really familiar with the otters that we have along our river.
Okay.
They're pretty common.
Okay.
You know, we see them quite a bit.
Okay. Yeah, the only reason I ask is not that otters can't kill chickens, but I'm not aware that it's terribly common for them to kill chickens. You know, things like raccoons.
Well, that's what we thought. We were worried about. We have fox and we have raccoons.
Yeah, raccoons, fox, coyote, you know, the weasels will get them. Mm-hmm. Owls will certainly get them. So one thing you might want to do is when you do butcher your chickens, you know, if you can control the scraps and dispose of them someplace other than on a refuse pile.
Yeah, I mean, this was just all happened so quick. We just were not expecting it. So
sure.
You know, he was quickly trying to take care of them. But, you know, we were just so surprised that it was so bold during the day like that. And actually, I had seen the otter kind of scouting around a few weeks ahead of time. So I think he'd been sort of keeping an eye on things. And we had them in a run during the day, but enclosed at night. And he apparently just kind of took his chance and went in. But he would went like on a murder rampage and just killed them all.
Yeah.
He hit them in the neck.
Yeah.
And just, you know, went on a rampage. So.
Well, it's not the otters, I guess, couldn't do it. Otters are typically more of an aquatic, you know, fishing type species. I mean, what you described sounds a lot more to me like a weasel.
What weasels do.
Yeah, and we've got long-tailed weasels, and we've got long-tailed, short-tailed, and least weasels. A long-tailed weasel is not as big as, is not even close to being as big as an otter, but the crime of the moment or the passion of the moment when you see all these chickens getting devastated, and things are happening so fast, it's again, I don't want to necessarily question your idea of the animal, but what you described sounds a lot more like weasels than it does otters. But
and then would they do that during the daytime?
They could. Yeah, they certainly, it's more common for them to do it at night, but they certainly could do it during the daytime. But you know, unfortunately, I'm sorry that happened. I guess the best thing for you to do is just now that you're aware that it could happen, just you know, try to keep those chickens more penned up and inaccessible to wildlife. The better you can during the day and night.
We've got laying hens too, and they're just fully enclosed. So,
yeah,
we'll be watching out for them.
So the other thing you can do, if you wish, and Susan from Upper Michigan, I apologize for doing this to you since you asked the trapping question. Mm-hmm. But the other thing you can do, if you wish, is contact. If you don't know a trapper, you can contact. You can look up the Wisconsin Trapping Association, and you may want to have a trapper come out and perhaps set some traps, especially during the trapping season when the fur is prime. Set some traps to perhaps reduce the population out there of otters and or perhaps weasels.
All right, very good.
All right, thanks very much for calling. Yeah, appreciate your call. Boy, you know, I'm thinking about this, we had a lot of questions about how do I get rid of of something as opposed to other types of questions. Yeah. We do have a comment coming up on white deer in Taylor County, and I know David will have some comments on that. And I also know that we're after our break today at 12:06, we're going to have a quiz question for you that deals with wildlife. And when we'll pick a winner at random from all the correct answers, and that person's going to receive a Stokes Guide to the Birds of the Eastern United States. So that's something to look forward to. And David's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. And I hope you will stay with us. Lots in store with him on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk with David Drake, a wildlife specialist with UW Extension, associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at the UW, with us to talk, obviously, about the world of wildlife. He had a great idea to throw a quiz question out to all of you. We'll pick a winner at random from all the correct answers, and that person will receive a Stokes Guide to the Birds of the Eastern United States. You can call 1-800-642-1234 with your number, or email it to talk@wpr.org. If you email, please put quiz in the subject line and also include where you live in the message. And here is the question. In terms of total number of individuals, what is currently the rarest living bird species in Wisconsin? And I guessed it, and Judah said, how did you know that? We'll give you until 12:15 to get your answers in, so you only have about 7 or 8 minutes here. Again, in terms of total number of individuals, what is currently the rarest living bird species in Wisconsin? Call or email with your answer. All right, there we go. And Mike in Madison has a question for you. So let's go to Mike. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Larry. Two quick ones, actually. I've got a yellowfinch who is enamored with the screen windows on my lower level windows. He's taken a hole probably 6 inches by 4 inches, and he keeps digging. Is there a way to stop him from getting up the screens? He doesn't seem pissed off at the window or anything. He just wants a piece of screen in his mouth.
You know what? I'm guessing you're talking about the American goldfinch, which is a yellow bird with a black forehead on it, and it's got black wings.
Exactly.
You know, we had the same thing happen to our house a couple of years ago. We up in our upper story bedroom windows for some reason, and it was just two windows. That finch just kept going at it, and my wife says, "Well, you're the wildlife guy, do something." But I'm also lazy, so I eventually let it take care of itself, and eventually the bird went away. And that's one option. Again, is you can do nothing, just let especially if the screen's already been damaged. Perhaps you just want to leave the damaged screen there and just let it peck away until it's content, and it'll eventually stop doing that, and you can replace the screen at that point. Otherwise, again, I know you say doesn't seem to be irritated at the window. It may actually see its reflection, and you could try to put in some kind of a decal up there to break that reflection up. You can try to take your screen down, and perhaps instead of putting the screen up, put something a little bit more durable like hardware cloth or chicken wire up that protects the window, but the animal actually can't tear apart. And then finally, which is going to take a little bit more work on your part, is anytime you see that bird, just get your garden hose out and spray some water up at it and just harass it and try to, every time you see the animal in the area, just spray some water at it or harass it away from that area.
Okay, fair enough. The Second quick one is we have a lot of bird feeders around, and they attract the ground squirrels, too, like the little 13-stripe chubs.
Yep. Yep.
Is there any way to deter them from digging holes all over my yard without killing them?
Not necessarily, and they will be in your yard whether you have feeders there or not, most likely, especially in urban-suburban type areas. So, you know, you can, again, similar to that question we just had about chipmunks, you could certainly try a live trap, a Sherman live trap if you want to. But, again, I understand the desire not to kill it, but they are making more and more of those every day. So if you wanted to certainly get a rat trap and bait it with peanut butter and put it by the hole, which is a kill trap, you certainly would not put a dent in the population at all. And that's an easy enough way to take care of them as well.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. We had a Facebook question from David. Our Madison neighborhood recently had the pleasure of playing host to a family of red-tailed hawks. That being said, they seem to have all left. Is that typical of red-tailed hawks to take up residence and relocate as the young get older? It was sure fun to watch them fly around the neighborhood. And he's got a picture of one of the young birds eating out of the neighbor's gutter. Huh. Let's see if I have, if I get that up here yet.
Interesting.
Let's see.
Well, as you look for the picture, Larry, I'll talk about the red-tailed hawks.
Yeah.
So red-tailed hawks are probably the most common raptor we have in Wisconsin. Raptors certainly are owls, hawks, eagles, kestrels, things like that. They're easily identifiable by that red tail. They're a very big bird, and they're common really in quite a bit of part of the state, suburban areas, farm lots, kind of on the edge of forested areas. And they really are just a beautiful bird. And I'm not sure what's going on this year, but I've had a couple of pictures emailed to me as well about some young red-tailed hawks sitting on people's railings of their back porch and all sorts of other things like that. And it is just a neat animal. They are a resident.
It's a cool picture,
yeah, it's a really cool picture up there. And I'm not sure what kind of a bird it looks like, maybe like a crow or some kind of a black bird it looks like in there. But they are a resident species. They don't really migrate, and they kind of hang out in the same general local area. So it may just be that, again, they've moved to a different area within their home range, and it's away from your house, and they'll be back. Or perhaps they're still around there, and again, they're there when you are not.
And there was a snake posted, a picture of a snake as well. And where is it?
Yeah, I remember the picture, and I'm quickly becoming irritated with pictures of snakes since the identification is being called into question. But the snake, and I will say this, I get pictures emailed to me all the time, and that's one of the benefits, I guess, of modern technology. But it is also sometimes hard to ID the animal positively because of the quality of the picture. However, this particular snake, and again, if somebody wants to question me on this, please do, but this particular snake, it's coiled up on kind of the sill of the barn. It looks to be a rather large snake, and to me, it looks like a fox snake, which is a pretty common snake in Wisconsin. Fox snakes are typically some people will call them copperheads because they have a copper head to them. They are not a copperhead like we would have down in the southeastern part of the southeastern part of the United States. Copperheads down there are venomous snakes. This copperhead, or what truly is a fox snake, is not venomous at all. It's a non-venomous snake, and really just a beautiful, beautiful snake.
And we have Laura and Amory with a question for you. So let's go to Laura. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm just calling about the territory of otters. It was the very first time we saw evidence of one was just in the late spring when there was just a little bit of snow on the ground, and we saw this real interesting-looking trail that looked like a snake, but it was really fat. Didn't know what it was, and then a friend of ours told us that it was probably an otter. We don't live on any waterfront. There's a few ponds in our woods, and gosh, the closest lake is probably 5 miles away. So I was just curious, you know, what is, was that kind of, do they have a pretty broad range in spite of the fact that we don't live near water?
I'm sorry. So you saw this animal, water is nearby though. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, like, you know, there's a lake, Lake Wapagasset, which is about 5 miles from where we live, and then there's some ponds nearby, but that, you know, that's all that we have.
Okay.
We didn't see the animal. We just saw the tracks.
Oh, you saw the tracks of the animal. Okay. So, you know, typically otters are pretty tightly tied to water. They certainly will move between water bodies, or they can obviously, you know, they can walk on land and they can move away from water, but they're pretty tightly tied to water. I'm wondering if it was a mink that perhaps you saw. And minks are pretty common. They're an all-black animal. They've got a long tail. They kind of have that loping run to them like an otter would. And they're a tubular type animal. The shapes, okay. Body shape's tubular like a otter would be as well. And mink are pretty common. They're all black. The one thing you'd look for in a mink is they've got a white chin patch a white patch of fur underneath their chin. As for the tracks, probably the best thing to do is either look up online, you know, Google otter tracks, mink tracks, and things like that.
Yes, and we did that, and it, you know, the tracks that we thought, you know, were otter tracks looked exactly like what we saw.
Okay.
But would that also, is that what mink tracks look like through them?
No, otters are a bigger animal, so the track would be a little bit bigger. If that's what it matched up to be and what you saw online, then that probably is what it is.
Probably using one of the ponds or some of the ponds that are in the neighborhood.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we didn't see the animal, but it was a thrill to see the tracks.
Do you know, are there fish in the ponds?
I don't think so.
Okay.
They're frogs.
Frogs. Well, they'll eat frogs, so well, it could be. So that's neat to see it.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. William sent a shot of a sandhill crane and a picture, a nice one, and then he says he's seeing a lot of cranes this year. How soon before they start flocking together before the big flight south?
Well, they should start flocking together here pretty soon. They are a late migrant, so they don't take off until well into November, or let's say, you know, mid to late October through November. So they'll start flocking up here pretty soon, and then we'll start flying south as late as through November and as late as late November.
And Rory in Chippewa Falls has seen white deer in Taylor County. How common are they in Wisconsin? You see, there are actually quite a few.
Yeah, they can be, Rory. And white deer, it could be what's called a piebald deer. It's not a true albino, or it could be a true albino. And if it's true albino, it would have a pink nose and pink eyes. Obviously, white deer stand out quite a bit within the environment, and because of that, that is not conducive to a long-lived animal. So a lot of people like to shoot them. They're easy to see, both for predators and hunters. And so I'm not sure how many there are out there, how common they are, but they are easy to see, and because of that, they're easy pickings for a lot of different predators.
Email from Chris in St. Paul or the St. Paul area. I've been thinking about trying to eat pigeon. I shoot as pests on friends' farms. I'd read an article recently arguing that pigeon was an excellent protein source. Granted, I'd only eat farm pigeons because I know they'll be eating grain and seed, unlike the city ones. Also, your opinion on crow as well, though they are carrion eaters. What do you think?
Well, times must be awfully tough, Larry. You know, pigeons are not much different than doves. Pigeons are called a rock dove, and there is a mourning dove season that will start September 1st, like in the past years. Mm-hmm. And I think mourning dove are very good to eat. When I was in graduate school in Texas, we go out on mourning dove shoots, and you know, they taught me after you shoot them, to breast them out, wrap the breast around a piece of jalapeno pepper, and then wrap all of that in bacon and put it on the grill, and it was a pretty tasty recipe. So I say give it a shot, and I don't know of people eating crow either, but you know, I think as long as the meat is cooked so that you're killing whatever might be in that meat that could harm you, I can't see anything wrong with it.
I haven't eaten crow. I've eaten pigeon. There's actually a pigeon pot pie.
Yeah.
I've had that was quite good.
Well, eating crow is also the expression for eating crow, so maybe that's what he means.
Yeah, maybe so. We have Marge in Cedarburg next. Marge, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, my daughter has recently camped with the family in Wisconsin, and after she got the heck home to Portland, was taken ill. And she still is ill, and it turned out to be caused by a bacteria called Ehrlichia that is carried by the deer tick. And I have a son-in-law whose brother was camping around the Dells, And he also came down with this Ehrlichia, and it is from the deer tick in Wisconsin. My daughter went back to Portland, Oregon, where she lives, and they didn't know how to deal with it out there. They didn't know. I think they're just now getting information from the blood test. So there is a antibiotic or some medication that is effective for this Ehrlichia, but it's been very slow coming with my daughter. So when someone was talking about the different things, you know, the Lyme disease and so forth, this Ehrlichia is a very serious illness. It's
a
temperature of 103 and, you know, very severe headache and chest rash. And
I'm sorry to hear about your daughter.
Yeah.
Well, she's a little better every day, but, you know, it's a long time. Serious illness. And so I think people should realize that this is in, as far as I know, it's in Wisconsin and Minnesota, but they never heard of it out in
out east, or out west, sorry.
Well, that's too bad. I'm sorry, and I know with Lyme disease that antibiotics are the proper course of treatment. It sounds like the doctor's got the right answer for it, and hopefully she'll have a quick recovery.
Yes, thank you very much for bringing that to our attention. Appreciate it very much. You know, we had a quiz, and with the winner, and the quiz question was, in terms of total numbers of individuals, what is currently the rarest living bird species in Wisconsin? And we had four people who correctly guessed piping plover.
And that is it. Good job.
And the winner of our quiz is Gary Makowski from Lac du Flambeau. So, Gary, we will be sending you a Stokes Guide to the Birds of the Eastern United States. So
excellent.
There you go.
Well done. And do we have time to share a little bit of information about the piping plover?
Absolutely.
So it had to be one of the three federally endangered bird species in Wisconsin. Those three are the whooping crane, and there's about 96 individuals plus some, depending on how this nesting season goes. Or it could be the Kirtland's warbler, and there's about 22 males and 11 females and maybe up to 17 fledged young this year. But it is piping plover, and it is a small shorebird, about 7 inches tall. And there's three nesting areas primarily in the United States, one along the Atlantic coast, one in the Great Plains along rivers and shores, and then one in the Great Lakes. And here in Wisconsin, they used to be a relatively common bird. They are not anymore, a lot of times because of habitat destruction along the shoreline and nest interference or predation as well. And so I believe lately the most piping plovers we've had in Wisconsin, one time nesting is six pair, which would be 12. They are a really, really neat bird. If you get a chance to see them, go up toward Ashland County and take a look on the shores of Great Lakes up there.
Several callers called in to say that what killed the Cornish hens was could have been mink.
That could be, possibly. And that's, you know, mink would be still, they're smaller than otters, but they are, mink's a pretty good-sized animal, and they certainly are a killing machine. There's no doubt about that.
And a Facebook question from John. I've noticed egrets for the first time this year. Why all of a sudden?
That's a good question. Why all of a sudden, John? The egrets are a pretty common wading bird here in Wisconsin. And you know, we've got great blue herons, which are very common. That's not necessarily an egret, but it's a wading bird like that. But probably the most common and most noticeable egret is the great egret, which is a relatively large kind of regal white bird. It's got a yellow bill on it. And a lot of times you'll see them stalking in wetlands for fish and amphibians and things like that. And just a really, really pretty bird.
They are.
And unfortunately, a lot of the wading birds, they've made some very nice recoveries across the United States, but they were one of the types of birds that were persecuted quite heavily back in the 1800s, early 1900s, for their feathers for women's clothes.
Yeah. And we had several people called about the bat and the rabies issue.
Yep.
And there was Gina Gezi was bitten in 2004 by a bat she picked up from the ground. They didn't seek treatment right away, and so traditional treatments weren't possible. She survived as a result of experimental treatment and just graduated from college this year.
I think, and good for her, and
yeah.
That's a relief she survived, but I think she's the only person, definitely in Wisconsin, but I think she's one of the only people in the United States who survived a rabies bite without treatment.
Dale and Rhinelander, we're on to you. Hi, Dale.
Yes, I have about a question about black squirrel. Are they a true black squirrel, or is there a hybrid of a gray squirrel, or what are they?
Mm-hmm. It is most likely a gray squirrel, and gray squirrels mm-hmm. have a number of different morphs to them or pelage colors, but black is certainly one of those pelage colors. As a matter of fact, I was just up in northern Wisconsin at our Kemp Natural Resource Station last week and saw a relatively good-sized black squirrel myself.
Ah.
So they're pretty common, and it's just a mutation of the pelage.
There you go. Thank you for calling, Dale. And Peggy in Blue River, your turn. Hi, Peggy.
Hi. We live in a wildlife-filled area.
Yep.
And come across several species of snakes. And recently, a rattlesnake was in our driveway. My 8-year-old son came upon it, and I was able to get in my car and move it out of our yard. But I'm wondering when it's okay to kill a rattlesnake.
Well, preferably never. Mm-hmm. You know, if you are in danger and for example, you are about to get bit.
Or your son, or
even the pet to protect yourself, I think that would be certainly understandable and people would, understand that situation. But rattlesnakes are relatively rare. And the Massasauga, as we've mentioned, is a state endangered species. The timber rattlesnake is a protected species and is believed that there are not a lot of those species or a lot of those individuals and the numbers probably are declining out of habitat loss and persecution. So it's preferable you don't kill them at all. But if your health is in immediate danger, certainly it would be understandable if you did.
So who would I call to remove a snake?
Well, you might want to just talk to somebody in the DNR who's in your local area, and they probably would know somebody who is a herpetologist or is familiar with snakes and can handle the snake both in a way that the human doesn't get hurt, but also the snake doesn't get hurt. So you can try that as well. Do you have rocky, like bluffs or south-facing hillsides in your property?
We do.
Yeah, and that's a very common habitat for snakes. That south-facing hillside absorbs a lot of the heat and gets most of the sun during the day. And snakes are cold-blooded, as you know, and so they like to go into those warm spots to warm their bodies up. And that south-facing hillside or rocky area is a great habitat for that. So it is, not to alarm you, but it is possible. You may have more than one rattlesnake on your property, and as you already indicated, you've got multiple species of snakes on your property for that reason. It sounds like you have very good habitat there.
Yeah.
Then one last question. What is the relationship between a bull snake and a rattlesnake? Some have told me that bull snakes are good to have around because they can deter rattlesnakes from coming into the area.
Yeah, bull snakes will certainly, let me think back in my head here. I believe bull snakes are immune from the rattlesnake bite, and I believe that they are a predator of rattlesnakes.
Mm-hmm. And with that, we have to conclude our conversation. David, thank you so much. You'll come back and be with us again?
I would love to. Thank you, Larry.
We'll have you back. David Drake, wildlife specialist with UW Extension and associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at the UW-Madison. We'll have him back, and we'll do this again. It's always fun to talk about the wildlife, isn't it? Tomorrow at 11, Sandy Chalmers and Michelle Reinen from the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection will be with us for 90 minutes to talk about consumer issues. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.